Americana. In the meantime, we must not forget the children. No one else could. Although Christmas is supposed to be the season of good cheer, you or I, for that matter, couldn't have told from listening to the little ones but what it was the children's Armageddon season, when nature had decreed that only the fittest should survive in order that the race might be carried on by the strongest, the most predatory, and those possessing the best protective coloring.
The words you have just heard were written by Robert Benchley, and they appear in his new collection, The Benchley Roundup. This program is Americana, the 10th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Some Pleasant People.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. This is the last Americana program that we shall be able to bring you before Christmas. Next week at this time, our program will be canceled in favor of some very fine Christmas programs brought to you over the NBC network. So when we next are able to talk together, it'll be Christmas evening, and the excitement will be pretty much over, and we shall have other things to talk about besides the holiday season. Meantime, Christmas approaches, and I must admit that I've picked the books that we are to discuss tonight with that fact in mind. Christmas is an all-pervasive holiday. Please believe that I wouldn't deny Christmas to Christianity, or ever be willing to forget that we celebrate this happy season because it was once the birthday of a child. A child who is shortly to become a displaced person, and so to provide a model for many an unfortunate newborn babe in our own unhappy century. But I like to remember, too, that before the birth of Christ, many and many a nation felt the appropriateness of a religious and a secular feast at the time of the winter solstice.
When the angels appeared to the wandering shepherds as they kept watch over their sheep in the fields near Bethlehem, the celestial chorus sang that glorious song of old, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men." So began our most beloved religious festival, Christmas, or Christus Mass, a celebration at the time of the winter solstice, when all were looking forward to the coming of the spring, was not an original idea with the Christians. For many years before Christ's birth, other religious groups had held festivals connected with the earth's fertility at the same season. The Romans, for example, observed the lavish Saturnalia, honoring Saturn, their god of agriculture, from the middle of December to the beginning of the new year. In northern Europe, the pagan Teutonic tribes, whose new year began at the time of the winter solstice, met at that period to honor their all-father, Woden or Odin. After gathering their harvests, they slaughtered animals for meat during the following month. This was the natural time for feasting and general rejoicing. By the light of bonfires, they consumed quantities of food and drink during their Yuletide season, the rebirth of the sun.
These paragraphs come from a very pleasant little book recently published by Harper and Brothers, All About Christmas by Mamie R. Cryth, a book which you might very well like to read and have around the house during this Christmas season. As Christmas time comes nearer, I find that my tastes in reading change. I like small books, and books about small topics, and books that are personal rather than cosmic. I'd prefer to postpone, at least until the 1st of January, reading the big works, the great works, the major literary efforts. Here's one example of the sort of thing that I rather enjoy at this season of the year. I recently received a copy of a delightful book called The Contemporary Mouse, written by Patricia Barnard. This brief fable is about a cultured mouse by the name of Micerinus, whose father had moved into the Boston Museum of Fine Arts so that his son might have the best possible educational advantages. The Contemporary Mouse tells the story in photographs, sketches, and text of how Micerinus traveled through the museum, meeting such interesting animals as the Saxon bronze lion, the English porcelain dog, the Egyptian marble cat, and the Indian stone lion, in an attempt to decide whether it was really such a very terrible thing to be a contemporary mouse. Now, that's the sort of thing that I rather enjoy as we get into the month of December. But even more than this, at Christmas time I have a particular liking for the pleasant people, the kindly, amiable, and rather unpretentious writers who speak primarily for themselves and not for causes and not for eternity. I don't mean to say that I go thoroughly sentimental at Christmas. As a matter of fact, my favorite piece of Christmas literature is a little sketch done by Robert Benchley a number of years ago. And it certainly is not sentimental. It's called Christmas Afternoon.
What an afternoon. Mr. Gummidge said that in his estimation, there had never been such an afternoon since the world began. A sentiment which was heartily endorsed by Mrs. Gummidge and all the little Gummidges, not to mention the relatives who had come over from Jersey for the day. In the first place, there was ennui, and such ennui it was. A heavy, overpowering ennui, such as results from a participation in 8 courses of steaming, gravied food, topping off the salted nuts, which the little old spinster Gummidge from Oak Hill said she never knew when to stop eating. And true enough, she didn't. A dragging, devitalizing ennui, which left its victims strewn about the living room in various attitudes of prostration, suggestive of those of the petrified occupants in a newly unearthed Pompeian dwelling. An ennui which carried with it a retinue of yawns, snarls, and thinly veiled insults, and which ended in ruptures in the clan spirit serious enough to last throughout the glad new year. In the meantime, we must not forget the children. No one else could. Although Christmas is supposed to be the season of good cheer, you, or I for that matter, couldn't have told from listening to the little ones but what it was the children's Armageddon season, when nature had decreed that only the fittest should survive in order that the race might be carried on by the strongest, the most predatory, and those possessing the best protective coloring. Although there were constant admonitions to Fonlandsby to let Ormond have the whistle now, it's his, and to Arthur Jr. not to be selfish, but to give the kitty car to Effie. She's smaller than you are. And the net result was always that Fonlandsby kept the whistle and Arthur Jr. rode in permanent, albeit disputed, possession of the kitty car. Oh, that we mortals should set ourselves up against the inscrutable workings of nature. And finally, Mrs. Gummidge passed the Christmas candy around. Mr. Gummidge afterward admitted that this was a tactical error on the part of his spouse. I no more believe that Mrs. Gummidge thought they wanted that Christmas candy than I believe that she thought they wanted the cold turkey, which she later suggested. My opinion is that she wanted to drive them home. At any rate, that's what she succeeded in doing. Such cries as there were of, oh, don't let me see another thing to eat. I'll take it away. And then came hurried scramblings in the coat closet for overshoes. There were the rasping sounds made by cross parents when putting wraps on children. There were insincere exhortations to come and see us soon. Get together for lunch sometime. And finally, there were slammings of doors and the silence of utter exhaustion while Mrs. Gummidge went about picking up stray sheets of wrapping paper. And as Tiny Tim might say in speaking of Christmas afternoon as an institution, God help us, everyone.
I've said before, and I say again, that Robert Benchley was a great man. No book club ever selected one of Mr. Benchley's books, and I'm sure that Cecil B. DeMille will never film any part of his work in Technicolor and CinemaScope. But perhaps these are recommendations in themselves. Beside the Benchley Roundup and the other books that we've so far mentioned to you, I've turned up 2 other volumes that I want to bring to your attention, both of them, I assure you, by very pleasant people. The first of these is The Love Letters of Phyllis McGinley. Miss McGinley, as I am sure that many of you know, has for many years been publishing her verse in The New Yorker and elsewhere. It's been very good verse, humorous, intelligent, perceptive, and sometimes a little barbed. For example, one of my favorite pieces in her new collection is called Mrs. Sweeney Among the Allegories. After this one, Mr. T.S. Eliot will scarcely dare show his face in any respectable club. Let's listen to the last few lines of Mrs. Sweeney.
Between the idea and the interpretation, between the epigram and the guffaw, falls the symbol. Between the intermission and the finale, between the horns and the dilemma, falls the symbol. Between the first level and the third level, between the dark and the daylight, between Grand Central Terminal and Larchmont, New York, falls the symbol. Here, then, is the story. T. Eliot, the Anglican who feared God, removing his bowler, furling his umbrella, set down in Riddle's dogma for the crowd. Now he's in Africa with another fella, leaving behind no confidential glossary. I hope he's not run over by rhinoceri. For this is the way his farce ends. This is the way his farce ends. This is the way his farce ends, not with a mole, but a moral.
But for most of the poems and the love letters, Miss McGinley has extracted the sting, or rather the sting was never there in the first place. For example, one of the most charming Christmas poems I've seen in late years is Miss McGinley's Christmas Eve in Our Village.
Main Street is gay, each lamppost glimmers, crowned with a blue electric star. The gift tree by our fountain shimmers, superbly tall, if angular, donated by the men's bazaar. With garlands proper to the times, our doors are wreathed, our lintels strewn. From our two steeples sound the chimes, incessant through the afternoon. Only a little out of tune. Breathless with boxes hard to handle, the grocery drivers come and go. Madam, the chairman, lights a candle to introduce our club's tableau. The hopeful children pray for snow. They cluster, mittened in the park, the talk of morning half affrighted. And early comes the winter dark, and early are our windows lighted to wheedle homeward the benighted. The eggnogs lifted for libation. Silent at last, the postman's ring. But on the plaza near the station, the carolers are caroling. Oh, little town, the carolers sing.
Miss McGinley was in town a few weeks ago, and I made an appointment to go down and see her. I wanted most particularly to find out how a writer of what I suppose we must still call light verse manages to follow her profession and to survive in the middle of the 20th century. I'm glad to be able to tell you that Miss McGinley, going her pleasant way, writing her skillful and delightful verse, is surviving very nicely indeed. I asked her what she thought of being called a writer of light verse. Here is what she had to say.
I do like the term, as long as people don't think it means jingles.
Uh-huh.
You see, I've spent about 15 years trying to prove that the line between light verse and poetry wasn't any stronger than the 49th parallel, that there is no real line of demarcation between light verse and poetry. It's only been recently that people have thought if you wrote light verse, you weren't a poet, you see. And I like to think that the acclaim, that seems a little immodest, but the perfectly delightful reviews that this book has had prove that a light verse writer can also be a poet.
Mm-hmm. Well, a light verse writer can even be quite a serious writer.
Well, you have to be serious.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you see, the whole essence of real light verse is to criticize in some way or to highlight the serious things of life in a light and enjoyable way. And until fairly recently, I think, many of the major poets were light verse writers. Marvel and Herrick and the Cavaliers and Chaucer. Chaucer was a light verse writer, really.
Yes, of course.
So that it's only been recently there's been this great line of demarcation. And I like to think that I'm helping to obliterate it.
Well, that's an interesting notion. Where do you... Let me back up just a little bit. You said a moment ago that a writer of light verse tends to criticize things in a light, a pleasant, and enjoyable way. Do you think of yourself mostly as a satirist?
I like to. Of course, that's an awfully important phrase, because the great satirists are the great men. I mean, Swift and the Greeks and Dr. Johnson and so on. Those I can't say that I'm a satirist in the great vein. But if by satire you mean elegantly saying one thing and meaning another, then I think in my best work I am a satirist.
I notice in your new book you remark right at the opening that you find yourself a little gentler now than you used to be.
I think as one gets older, one has to... There's only two things to do as you get older. You either accept the world with a kind of pleasant resignation as it is, or you get bitter and angry. And evidently, I've stopped being angry.
Let's take a look not at the satirical poems that you've written, but at the ones in which you celebrate things that you like, that you have a friendly feeling for, and so on. I don't notice it so much in your new book as I did in the previous one. What was it?
Short Walk from the Station.
Where you're talking about the joys of suburban living.
I was defending suburbia then. The whole reason for that book was that I had really become quite angry at all the novelists who use suburbia as the jumping off place, the standard for mediocrity, and I didn't feel that was true at all. I thought it was a fine kind of invention, suburbia.
What's so good about suburban living?
Of course, when I talk about suburban living, I mean living with children. I think it's the perfect kind of living for children. It's still controversial, the idea, but I think that a good suburb is better than the city and better than the country for children, because it's a life, a real centered life for them. But it's not at the mercy of one little group as a small town is, and it hasn't all the inconveniences of the city.
You don't...
I've lived in all of them, so I know.
Yes. you don't think that the suburbs are a little too new and a little too transitory, maybe too much the subject to the commuter's routine to be a very good place to live in, huh?
I think it's hard on husbands having to commute. And yet my husband screams if I even so much as mention moving back to the city. But for a child, for instance, our suburb, with the Long Island Sound at our doors, with everything that a child could ask, and the same playmates in the same friends in their teens that they had when they were born, ours is not a too transitory suburb. I think that's a wonderful thing. I've lived in the country, and it's not a happy thing for children necessarily, because children want friends more than anything. They'd rather have that than all the sermons and stones and so on that you can that you can give them. And after they're 16 or so, I don't think it matters. But when they're children, this warm, close suburban life, I think it's a fine thing for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you a little bit more about how to be a poet here. Can poets make a living writing poetry nowadays?
Well, that's a very immodest question.
Well, let me put it this way. You do much more in a professional way, I think, than writing verse, don't you?
Yes, but I've made a living on writing just poetry.
Is that so?
And I think some people have been able to. Certainly Mr. Nash has been able to. Robert Frost has been able to.
Well, I was just reading Malcolm Cowley's new book, Literary Situation. Have you seen that?
Yes, I saw that. Very amusing, I thought.
Yes, this one sentence that he has in which he says that Nash and Frost are the only poets he knows.
Well, one of the critics in New York took exception to that. He said, how about McGinley and Hammerstein?
Well, there's a good combination.
Yes.
You've never done any lyrics for...
Yes, I have. I did some of the lyrics for a musical called Small Wonder, which you may have heard of, mm-hmm. which ran on Broadway several months. But the theater is too difficult for me. I have family and children, and the theater means being out of town a good deal, and I can't do that. I feel I can't do that.
Surely. So professionally, you have to... Do things that can be done in
that's
spare
right. in
pockets
my in
of
my
time.
In my spare time. Mm-hmm.
You do a good deal of lecturing too, I think,
no.
don't you? No, really?
No, I do almost none.
Ah.
But that's only again a matter of being home a good deal, and I don't want to get away, you see. I'm afraid I'm a homebody.
And now I'd like you to listen to one more poem from the McGinley Love Letters. Partly because I like this poem very much, and partly because it will serve to introduce you to the next writer that I want to talk about.
On the top of a pillar, Simeon sat. He wore no mantle, he had no hat. But bare as a bird sat night and day, and hardly a word did Simeon say. Under the sun of the desert sky, he sat on a pillar 9 feet high. When Fool and his brother came around to admire, he raised it another 9 feet higher. The seasons circled about his head. He lived on water and crusts of bread, or so one hears from Pilgrim's store for 30 years and a little more. And why did Simeon sit like that? Without a garment, without a hat, in a holy rage for the world to see? It puzzled the age. It puzzles me. It puzzled many a desert father. And I think it puzzled the good Lord, rather.
This allows me to tell you that there is a modern Simeon Stylites whose functions are not nearly as puzzling as those of the original saint. If you've ever read a journal called The Christian Century, you almost certainly have come across at least one letter signed with the pen name Simeon Stylites. The letters, of course, are really essays, and they appear quite regularly, thank heaven. I was particularly glad to see that the Oxford University Press had decided to publish a collection of the letters of Simeon Stylites, which is called Like a Mighty Army. Simeon, whose real name is Halford E. Lookock, is a member of the faculty of the Yale Divinity School, and I hardly suppose that he spends very much time sitting on columns, except, of course, in a metaphorical or Pickwickian sense. Simeon writes delightfully on subjects both religious and secular. For my own part, I could wish for nothing better than to spend the next two or three programs listening to his charming letters. But I suppose that instead we must be content to sample one of his letters. Here is Simeon on the Three Wise Men.
Sir, I heard the words being read in the days of Herod the king. Behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. Then my mind, never very strong at sticking to the point, frailed off. Suppose that the wise men had come from the west rather from the east. And suppose, too, that they shared and expressed some of the main, the dominant ideas and drives of our western civilization and world. What would have happened if it had been wise men from the west journeying eastward toward a star? The extra-canonical scriptures might have read something like this. The first wise man, being a top ruler in the western world, was a merchant prince, a big industrialist, ever alert to the opportunity of bigger and better sales. At the start of the journey, he said to himself, "We're going to be traveling through large, untapped markets. Now, I can follow the star,
and at the same time open up new outlets for the Casper Manufacturing Company, and I can triple our exports.
So he diligently called on all the tradesmen all along the way. He amassed a big sheaf of orders. But it all took time, delayed him greatly, so that the star faded, and he never got to Bethlehem at all. The second wise man had a true Western feeling for military power and defense. And he said to himself, "We will be traveling through the foreign nations and strange peoples. The gifts we bear will need armed protection. I must recruit a strong force, arm them well. Otherwise, we will never get to Jerusalem." But the recruiting, the problems of logistics, they all took time. And his soldiers were always getting into brawls with the soldiers of the nations through which they passed. Rome refused to allow such a menacing task force to pass through Italy. So they didn't get any farther than Gaul, where they went into winter quarters. The third wise man was very different from the other two in everything except his vision of the star and the desire to find the king. But he, too, was a true man of Western culture and aims. He had been called many harsh things by rivals, but no one had ever called him a shrinking violet. He had a high position, no less than president of Melchior, Melchior, Melchior and Melchior, advertising and public relations consultants. He said to himself, "This finding of a new king will be a tremendously big thing. It has great publicity possibilities, and it must be handled in a great big way. Now look, we'll be marching right into history, and the whole world, they must get the full story." So he was much engaged in giving out press releases at every town at which they stopped and entertaining local journalists. For the sake of complete coverage, he had made a detour into Egypt, which took 3 months. But by that time, the king of the Jews had been born at Bethlehem, and he never got to see the king at all, or to present his gifts. Perhaps it's just as well that the wise men came from the east. Perhaps the west, with all its power and skill, still misses the way to the star and the babe in swaddling clothes. Yours, Simeon Stylites.
You have been listening to Americana, the 10th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Malone. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Musical supervision by Maury Streetmatter. Engineering by Ed Gulley. The quoted materials were read by myself, Bill Grisky. The books mentioned on tonight's program were Halford E. Lookock's Like a Mighty Army, published by the Oxford University Press, The Love Letters of Phyllis McGinley, published by the Viking Press, Robert Benchley's The Benchley Roundup, published by Harper and Brothers, Patricia Barnard's The Contemporary Mouse, published by Coward McCann and Company, and Mamie R. Cry's All About Christmas, published by Harper and Brothers. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address and a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is NBC Radio.